while I bring the binos to my eyes, looking to see if there is evidence of anyone standing on the deck of La Primorosa. From this distance, while bouncing up and down on the water, it's impossible to tell. With a sigh, I say, "Looks like I'm going to have to try a bottom-up underway."
"A what?"
"Raiding a ship from the waterline while it's on the move."
"That sounds difficult."
I laugh. "It's a little challenging, yeah. I've done it before, but not without a lot of equipment, and not alone."
"How will you?"
She stops talking when I throttle back hard, putting the monomarine speedboat in neutral. It slows violently, knocking Talissa and me both forward. I could have warned her, but I hear the ticking clock in my head telling me I have to act fast. The time to hold her hand is past. I tell her, "You're going to have to drive the boat." After the ceaseless full-throttle engine rumble and the noise of the boat beating against the waves, the relative silence now is shocking. Talissa stares at me in disbelief and dread, and I know what she's going to say.
"Look, you showed me some things, but I've never done this before. I still don't know how."
"Do you know how to raid a vessel from the waterline while it's moving at 15 knots? She doesn't answer me, likely because she's tired of my smart-ass comments. I add, "Trust me, you've got the easy part in all this." Talissa leans over the side and vomits again. I just barely manage to suppress my own desire to hurl while I hold the wheel and focus on the approaching boat. I need to position myself nearly perfectly in the water to have any chance of pulling this off, and to get closer to the vessel's path, I turn slightly to the west and add a little power. It doesn't take me long before I throttle back yet again, and we bob there in the darkness. The yacht is less than a mile and a half away and closing steadily. Talissa sits there, staring at me, and I can feel the trepidation pouring off her.
"How are we going to do this?"
she finally asks. "I'm getting in the water, and you are going to pilot the boat in the direction of those lights on the coastline. Go slowly, one-third power. Make your way about halfway between me and the shore, maybe 1 mile out, and then throttle back to neutral. After La Primorosa passes by, keep your eyes out to sea, right here. If you see a light waving around in the water, that's me, and I wasn't able to get on board. Come and pick me up. If you don't see anything for 5 minutes, head for land. You should be able to beach it easily, but be sure to pick an area where the shoreline isn't too rocky."
"I don't know if I can do this," she says.
"I can't do it without you, and if I miss that boat and you don't come for me, then I'm dead."
"Don't put me in that position."
"Look around you. We're in that position. We can go home and forget this, or we can go forward. The only way forward is for me to try to hit that boat right now, while it's on the move." Her meek voice has returned.
"I'm just scared."
My voice isn't meek at all, but I share her sentiments. "Yeah, me too. Trust me, it doesn't go away, but after a while, you get used to it." I pull a bag of equipment up on the deck, retrieve my wetsuit, fins, mask, and snorkel. I leave my tank and the rest of my scuba gear because, as much as I'd love the ability to breathe underwater, there is no way I can pull myself aboard a swiftly moving boat with 50 pounds of shit on my back. I also retrieve the small backpack that is holding the rubber-coated utility anchor attached to the braided line, and I stuff my pistol and suppressor in it, along with my knife, a flashlight, and a small red light to use underwater. While Talissa watches the approaching yacht, I strip down to my underwear and wrestle into the 7mm wetsuit, pull the hood over my head, and slip on my fins. She starts to say something to me, maybe to protest again that she has no training to pilot a powerful motorboat on the open sea, alone, at night. But she registers the intense look on my face and realizes I am not a man to be reasoned with right now. I put the mask on, adjust the snorkel, and sit on the gunwale of the speedboat, facing in. Crossing my legs in front of me, I say, "You've got this, and so do I." Before she can reply, I pinch my nose and put my hand on my mask. I roll backwards off the gunwale, entering the water with the back of my head first, then doing a reverse somersault under the waves before resurfacing. With my head back above the waterline, I get her to hand me the backpack, and I put it on my chest with the straps over my shoulders.
Go,
I say. I'll call you when it's done.
5 minutes later, I am bobbing alone in the dark water, making little corrections with my fins as a very mild current tries to pull me offline from the oncoming vessel. My plan is as simple as it is crazy, but as I told Talissa, I've done something similar before. When the boat comes level with me, I will fin as hard as I can towards it, then throw the grappling hook at the metal railings alongside the sea stairs at the rear. I'll be lashed to the line, and then I'll use it to pull myself through the yacht's wake to the stairs. That's the plan, anyway. But it will only work if I can get close enough to throw, and if I can get high enough in the water to throw, and if I snag the hook on the rail, and if there isn't anyone standing right there to stop me. Easy day, Gentry. You got this. If there is anyone down on the lower deck by the sea stairs, this plan won't work at all. I'm not shooting someone from the water and then just climbing on board and fighting it out, as cool as that would be. So this plan of mine is conditional on what I see in a 1 or 2 second look at the stern, as well as the execution of my throw. Getting into position will be tough. I can't be right in front of La Primorosa when it passes, or it will either run me down or suck me down. Instead, I try to plant myself about 50 feet east of where it will pass. One thing's for sure, I'll only get one chance at this, and failure means those women sail off to Italy, or Slovenia, or somewhere else in Croatia, while Talissa and I motor back to shore, miles from town, with no earthly idea what to do next. But I can't think about the prospect of failure because La Primorosa is just a few hundred yards away now. I commit myself to my objective, put all my energy and focus into it, and prepare to move. The freediving fins I'm wearing have more than twice the surface area of regular swim fins, and this, along with decades of improving my finning technique, allows me to move like a torpedo through the water. I dive just a few feet, then begin working my legs as hard as I can, and I close on the path of the vessel. I can't see anything below the waves without my light, but using it now would tie up a hand I need for something else. So I just have to estimate how far away I am by my speed in the water and the loud humming noise coming from the 150-foot-long vessel. I surface, blow out my snorkel, and look up. The bow of the Primorosa is more or less where I'd hoped to find it, 50 feet in front of me to the west. The speed of the vessel up close is frightening, and the white caps of the bow wake along the hull are intimidating, because I'll be swimming right through that in seconds. I don't dive this time. I just lower my head, breathe through my snorkel, and kick like my life depends on it. My heart pumps wildly, thanks to the adrenaline and epinephrine and cortisone from the fear, excitement, exertion, and desperation. And as I kick, I have the weird presence of mind to realize something in this moment. I fucking hate to admit it, but I live for this shit. Just then, I feel the wake hit me, knocking me back to the left as the vessel churns the sea, heading to my right. 6 seconds later, I arch my back and my head surfaces. I kick as hard as I can while vertical, lifting my upper torso out of the water. The stern of the boat is close enough, but already past me, and I realize I should have surfaced a couple seconds earlier for an easier throw. From my imperfect view, I see no one on the lower deck by the sea stairs. So, while still kicking to keep my arms above the water and fighting the incredible wake, I swing my right hand over my head, hurling the 4-pound metal utility anchor up and over the stern railing. The rubber coating I sprayed on the tong masks any metal-on-metal noise, and I'm hoping the sound of the engine hides the clunking of the instrument when it hits the deck and again when it catches on the rail. I quickly wrap my wrist and forearm in the rope and hope like hell that I am yanked along in the water. I am violently jerked and towed behind the yacht. I pull myself, hand over hand, up the rope through the foamy wake, using all the strength in my arms, legs, and back to do so. The mask is ripped off my eyes by the force of the water, but it slides down onto my neck and not over my head. I gulp a mouthful of seawater and fight the incredible drag of the small pack on my chest trying to haul me under the surface. This is not the shit I live for.
But I keep pulling, and soon I take a hand off the rope and reach up to the sea stairs, looking for something to grab onto. I'm weakening by the second from the exhaustion and the need to suck in a breath of air, impossible in the heavy wake of the mega-yacht. A small tie-down is positioned just to the right of the water entry of the sea stairs, and my fingers take it in a death grip. I let go of the rope with my left hand now, wrap it over my clenched right hand, and, like I'm free-climbing a sheer wall, I pull myself out of the water and onto the lower stairs. I fight the urge to vomit and to cough up a large volume of the Adriatic Sea and to collapse down onto the deck because I haven't cleared the area around me yet. Barely able to function, I pull the suppressed G-19, rise onto my knees, and, still with the massive fins on my feet, I scan the rear portion of the lower deck over the top of the stairs. The area is clear. I drop back onto the lower stairs, out of view from the deck, and take a few seconds to recover from the exhausting swim. I gag out seawater for a few seconds, and this makes me feel a lot better. Finally, I remove my fins and fold them till they fit in the pack. Taking off my mask and snorkel, I shove these in as well. I'm head to toe in a hooded black wetsuit, with black neoprene boots and a black pack on my chest, which I shift around to my back after retrieving my knife from it. The blade and the pistol go in the utility pocket on my right thigh, and then I begin climbing the sea stairs again. I only make it a couple of feet before I drop back down, because a man in a short-sleeved black shirt is walking by from my right to my left. Luckily, I saw him before he saw me, but I nevertheless draw my blade and prepare to launch myself up the three remaining steps to shove it into his windpipe if he comes over here and peers down on me. 30 seconds later, I chance another glance and find the deck clear of hostiles, so I move up the stair towards the rear door to the saloon. My objective is the master's stateroom at the top of a staircase out of the saloon on the bridge deck and then down a hall aft. I don't know who is in this room, but I'm certain that whoever the big cheese on board is, they are going to get the best cabin. I make it up to the windows into the saloon and then duck down, crawling behind a little rear deck bar area to get a view of the well-lit room. Right across from me is the diving deck. Several scuba tanks, buoyancy control vests, hoses, and other equipment are fixed by bungee cord to racks along the bulkhead. I rise up on my knees but lower back down out of view as a slight list to port becomes apparent. It takes me only an instant to realize the boat is turning to starboard. Seconds later, it begins to slow. Are we heading in to land? Pulling my phone out of my pack, I take it from its waterproof case and turn on the GPS. It takes a minute to catch the satellite, but when it does, it shows that I'm a couple miles off the coast of the Croatian city of Rovinj. Shit, I think. Talisa wasn't exactly right, but she was close. La Primorosa was coming to northern Croatia, but to a smaller port than Pula for some reason, probably because I spooked them into changing their plans. Thinking over my next move, I decide to take advantage of the opportunity the nearby diving deck affords me. I shoot across the aft portion of the lower deck, crawling on my hands and knees under the windows to the saloon, and I grab the first scuba tank in the rack. Working in the dark, I strap a vest-like buoyancy control device to it, and then I attach the regulator and BCD inflator hose to the tank itself. I grab a few kilos of lead weights and drop them in pockets in the vest to help me sink below the surface. Now I open the tank valve and check to make sure it's full, test the regulator and emergency regulator by sucking air from them both, and then screw the valve shut again. I move the entire rig into the corner and throw a towel over it. I crawl back over behind the little bar, knowing that's the best hiding place here on the aft deck, unless, of course, some jackass decides to come out to make piña coladas. But as I rise, I check the saloon again and see a man moving up the circular staircase on the far side, 30 feet or so from me. He's wearing a black polo and carrying a small submachine gun on his chest. I duck back down to cover, but keep my eyes looking through the glass. Right behind the armed man, I see a woman. She is young with short blonde hair. I don't know who she is, but when she is followed by more women and girls, and they in turn are followed by a second armed man, I know exactly who they are. A total of 8 sex trafficking victims walk across the saloon and towards the port side hatch to the main deck. The lighting in the saloon is good, so I'm able to look over the faces, but of the 8 women I see, I don't see anyone who looks even remotely like the picture I saw of Talissa's sister. They are dressed in warm-up pants and yoga pants and t-shirts and sweatshirts. It appears their captors are treating them a lot better here than they'd been treated in Mostar. At first, I can't figure out where they are going, but the mystery about where the women are headed is solved 30 seconds later when I hear voices and then footsteps across the aft deck and on the other side of the little bar. The women round the stern of the vessel, then head onto the starboard side, where they disappear, moving along together towards the bow. When the entourage comes back around a second time a couple of minutes later, I understand. The women are being walked around up here for some air and exercise. I wait for them to pass a third time, but before a fourth trip around the deck, I see the girls walked back into the saloon and led back down the stairs below decks. I like my hiding place, but it's not going to get me anything I need, unless some guy who looks like a sex-smuggling mastermind happens to walk by alone on the aft deck. I decide again I have to go for the master stateroom, which means the staircase that runs up the brightly lit saloon 30 feet away. But before I can move, I see motion through the window again. Another group of women, 7 this time, are brought up and walked through the port side hatch. These girls are being escorted around the deck, just like the first group, obviously as a form of exercise. Shit, I can't go anywhere right now. Eventually, these ladies are taken back below decks, and 6 more come up. They travel the same slow, monotonous route around the deck. I've looked at every single woman, and none of them look like Roxana. After the last group goes down, the engines of La Primorosa begin to slow more. Then it sounds as if they are being powered back to neutral. Boat crew and armed men in suits walk around in the saloon, so I'm still stuck where I am. Soon I hear the voices of crew members over a walkie-talkie at the stern, and I imagine men standing back there, lowering the tender into the water. Almost on cue, the tender's outboards start up, and I hear it rumble around to the port side. I worry that they are going to start loading up the women to take them to shore, but instead, I see a tall, bald-headed Caucasian man in dark clothing come down the stairs with 3 armed men at his heels. All 3 head out the portside saloon hatch. A minute later, I hear the tender leaving the yacht, and then the quiet returns. The women have been given exercise, and then they were taken back below, so the only thing I can assume is that the men who boarded the tender are heading to land to pick up supplies, or perhaps even more women. I decide to wait here another few minutes, and then to make my way for the stairs.
28. Kostas Kostopoulos had readied his quarters, showered and dressed himself, taken his pills, and sprayed on copious amounts of cologne. He put on a red silk robe, leaving it open enough to reveal a hairy chest and a thin gold chain. He fingered the rings he kept on 6 of his fingers, and he slicked back his thin, silver mane. And when he heard the tender rumble away from the port side of his mega-yacht, he looked in the mirror and pronounced himself ready. He walked over to the little built-in nightstand next to his king-sized bed and pressed a button on a console, and the lock in the door to the upper deck passageway clicked open. He called out to his bodyguard, "Anton, come." A muscular, bearded Greek stepped up to the open doorway from where he'd been positioned at the top of the stairs.
"Sir?" "The product being held alone in VIP stateroom number 4. Bring it to me."
The younger man masked a smile.
"Right away, sir."
Now the 72-year-old reached into a drawer and retrieved a fistful of silk scarves of different colors. He tossed them around on the bed and on the floor haphazardly, then picked a few back up and placed them more methodically around the room. Jaco Verdorn had told Kostopoulos that Riesling wanted him to take one of the women from below into his bed. He did this with regularity. It was the only reason he traveled personally with the merchandise to market. But tonight was the first time he'd been asked to defile one of the special handling items. Kostas was reluctant at first. He knew the director himself would be on the yacht in just hours, and he did not want to do anything to bring on the powerful man's ire. But when Verdun explained they'd been having trouble with Maya, and the psychologist on board felt she'd get through to her more easily if she managed to form a bond with her after helping her cope with true trauma, then the Greek saw this as his one opportunity to sample the wares going directly to the man in charge of the entire consortium himself. And even though the past several days had been some of the most difficult in the Balkan pipeline, with the attacks by the American assassin known as the Gray Man, now that he was out on the water, away from the Balkans, Kostopoulos felt a reversal of fortunes coming his way. As he waited in his master's stateroom for the most beautiful and desirable woman in this, or perhaps any other shipment, to come up and fulfill all his prurient desires, he found himself amazed that he'd managed to get so fucking lucky in life. I stretched my hamstrings and then my IT bands behind the bar. The cold of the water, even with my wetsuit on, tightens my muscles and lessens my ability for explosive movement. But the stretching helps me counter this somewhat. And it's not like I have much else to do. I've been back here for a half hour now. The tender motored off 10 minutes ago, and even though it is 1,000 yards or so to the marina in Rovinia, I can't be sure the rigid-hulled rubber inflatable boat won't return soon. I tell myself I've got to get on with it. But as I prepare to move, I see yet another figure in the saloon. This time it's a muscular, bald-headed man with a beard, wearing a polo, and a Brueger and Thommet submachine gun over his shoulder, descending the circular stairs. He arrives on the main deck and immediately continues down to the lower deck. Something tells me to wait, and I do, but only for a minute. Then I see a woman ascend from below, followed by the bearded man, who holds a hand on her shoulder from behind. As she continues up the stairs, I focus on her carefully, curious as to why this one, who is being treated like a captive, is being escorted alone. I get a good look at her face as she steps onto the main deck before turning on the staircase to go up to the upper decks. Oh my God. It's Roxana. Talissa's sister is very much alive. My heart begins pounding now. I count my blessings she isn't being held with the others, and I realize there just may be a chance I can get her out of here. It will probably mean killing at least one guard and maybe more, and then a fast getaway. But considering what these assholes are up to, I see that as a feature of this plan, not a glitch. They climb to the upper deck, disappearing from my view. I want to follow them now, but the sound of a walkie-talkie nearby holds me in my hiding place, tucked behind the little bar. Roxana had been told to dress for dinner earlier in the evening, and fine clothes were brought to her by the staff. She dressed in white slacks and a sleeveless black top, expecting that she and Dr. Claudia would be having another session. She was led from her cabin, past a pair of armed guards in the foyer, up the stairs, and all the way to the upper deck. Here, she could see an open door to the bridge and an open door to a larger stateroom. The guard directed her aft towards the stateroom, and then he all but pushed her inside before closing the door. Here, an older man, wearing a red robe and leaning against a chair in a sitting area, just a couple steps away from her, smiled and beckoned her to come closer. His tan, hairy chest was exposed, and Roxana thought she might be sick.
"Good evening," he said in English.
She looked around and saw several silk scarves lying around the room, on the bed, on the floor in front of it, on the two chairs. She did not know what they were for, and she did not know why she was here.
"Who are you?"
she asked warily. The man said,
"Call me Kostas."
He reached out to shake her hand, and when she reluctantly offered hers, he grabbed her roughly by the wrist and yanked her off balance. As she screamed in surprise, he shoved her down onto the bed with a confidence in his eyes that told her this was nothing new for him. When she found herself on her back, the man said,
"I find it's best for everyone if we get right to it, don't you?"
Her heart felt like it would tear out of her chest now.
"No!"
Roxana began to hyperventilate, but through the fear, she felt rage. The older man said,
"I hear you are quite a brat, but I will take responsibility for teaching you how to behave going forward."
With that, he reached and grabbed one of her legs, yanked it to the end of the bed, and began wrapping a silk scarf around her bare ankle. She saw him tie the other end of the scarf to the low bedpost, and she fought to pull her leg away. The older man was surprisingly strong, and she could not break free. Right before he cinched the knot tight, however, Roxana used her other leg to kick him in the side of the head. The man in the red robe tumbled sideways to the floor, halfway to the lavatory, and Roxana scooted backwards along the bed until she had her back pressed against the headboard.
"Stay away!"
The man who called himself Kostas climbed back to his feet slowly. She could tell he was stunned and embarrassed, but not especially injured. His silver hair hung over his eyes, so he shook off the impact to his head, then smoothed it back into place.
"You," he said with a grin. "The rumors are right about you. You are one disobedient little bitch."
He moved forward confidently, but when she kicked out at him again, he took a step back to rethink his plan. He stepped over to a small writing desk in the corner of the room, then reached into a drawer and pulled out a large knife. It was in a sheath, but he waved it in the air in front of him.
"No, you don't want to fight with me, dear. Nothing good will come of it."
Roxana stayed where she was, eyes locked on the knife.
"No,"
he said after a few seconds.
"Maybe you would like me to bring some friends. That will make this a very special night for you."
She said nothing.
"Yes. One of my roughest men holding you down, with he and I passing you back and forth."
He smiled.
"Won't that be fun?"
He stepped around to the left of the bed. Roxana scooted to the other side, but he didn't leap for her or come at her with the knife at first. Instead, he pressed the button on his end table. She heard a loud click and realized he had just unlocked the door. The Greek called out now.
"Anton, come in."
Roxana said,
"I swear I will kill you if you touch me again."
Kostas just laughed and crawled onto the bed in front of her and unsheathed his knife. She backed away as much as she could, pressing herself tight against the headboard. When he moved closer, she slid off the bed but found herself in the corner by the other nightstand, with nowhere to go. Kostas lunged at her, forcing another scream out of Roxana. He crawled all the way over the bed and landed on the floor on the other side, all but pinning the young Romanian girl between the bulkhead and the side of the bed, with the nightstand and the wall behind her. He waved the shiny blade back and forth in front of his face, then moved forward again. This time, she clawed at his face, scratching at him. He swung the knife towards her reflexively. It missed her face by inches, but only because she fell backwards on the nightstand and then down to the floor. Roxana was on her knees in front of the Greek in the red robe now. She couldn't see who came through the door behind him, but she heard it open, then close and lock. The old man had all the advantages here. He had the knife, he had another man to help him, while she had her back to the wall and nowhere to maneuver. The young Romanian woman readied herself for his move down onto her. Her plan was to try to take the hand with the knife and jerk the man off balance, then disarm him and slit his throat. She knew the guard behind him would only shoot her for doing this, but she told herself she would rather die than submit. She reached up and clawed again, and her nails raked across the old man's right cheek. The man rubbed a hand over his face, then looked down at the blood on it. He screamed now.
"Yako was right about you. You aren't worth the trouble. Better I just cut your bitch throat and toss you overboard. I'll tell the director you committed suicide, and no one will ever talk."
He moved at her with the knife poised to strike. And then, without warning, Roxana watched as his scratched and wrinkled face turned from pale gray to bright red in an instant. Roxana couldn't tell what she was looking at, but quickly she realized she wasn't, in fact, looking at his face. It was a red silk scarf being brought down over his head, finally continuing down lower to wrap around his throat. And there, it cinched tight. The old man's eyes went wide with shock. He tried to swing back with the knife, but Roxana watched while a gloved hand at the end of an arm in black deftly disarmed him. And then the old man in the robe was lifted up into the air, his arms and legs flailing just feet from the Romanian in the corner on her knees. She stood up, pushed herself tighter into the corner, and she could see the new person in the room now. He wore a wetsuit and a hood over his head, but she saw enough of his face to register a short beard and intense eyes. He dragged the man over the top of the bed, finally heaving him back and into the middle of the stateroom, his bare feet dangling over the carpet as he was hanged by the silk scarf. Behind him, just this side of the door to the hall, the bald-headed guard in the black polo lay crumpled, his eyes open in death. The diver must have dragged in the body before shutting the door. The man in black spoke now, right into the Greek's right ear, in a soft, low voice that was strained with the effort of holding the man in the air by the throat. He said,
"You like it rough, buddy. I'll show you rough."
The old man's eyes locked on Roxana's, and then they slowly rolled back in his head. She held her hands in front of her mouth as tears ran down her face. The man in the wetsuit lowered the dead body down to the floor, then stood back up and looked her way. Roxana wanted to scream, but instead she held her breath, terrified of what would happen to her now. The killer moved a few steps closer to the end of the bed, looking to her. He jerked his head towards the body in the red robe.
"Who's he?"
Roxana cocked her head in bafflement. 29.
The girl doesn't appear hurt, and from the look in her eyes as I put my makeshift garrote around the old dude's head, she's a fighter. She was prepared to die in combat rather than yield to her attacker, and I have nothing but respect for that. Maybe I shouldn't have killed him, but the logistics of getting him off this boat along with Roxana didn't compute. I figure I can swim out of here with one person, and I'd much rather that person was going along willingly. The moment I saw Roxana, I decided she would get the other ticket off this boat. She could tell me where they were heading and who was who in this organization. She spends 5 seconds staring me down before replying in a halting voice.
I don't know who he was. How is it you don't know?
I don't answer her. Instead, I ask another question. Are you hurt? She replies by saying,
There are many men with guns on this boat.
Tell me about it. I ask again, Are you hurt? She looks me up and down, and then at the two bodies on the floor.
How can you kill two men and then just have a normal conversation?
I don't agree this is a normal conversation, but I take her point. I look down to the two bodies. They're bad guys, right? She nods.
Very bad.
I shrug. Fuck 'em. And then I ask a third time, Are you hurt?
I am okay.
The shock of the moment seems to have her in its grip, but her eyes soon clear and she looks into mine.
It's you. You were the man in the red room. The one who killed the Serbian?
You were there? She nods, looks to a point on the wall.
I was there.
I want to ask her about what happened after I left the farm, but I have more pressing matters at the moment. What's your name? I ask, although I know the answer. What I don't know, however, is her state of mind. I need to find out if any bonds have developed during her captivity that will make her a threat to me or my mission.
My name is It's Maya.
This is pretty standard in kidnapping situations. They've got her using a different name, both for operational security and as part of her re-education process. But I know, without a doubt, that this is the girl from the picture with Talissa. Nobody looks like this. I shake my head. No, it's not Maya. You are Roxana Vaduva. Her eyes shut and tears cascade down her cheeks. She sits down on the bed roughly and sobs softly with her face in her hands.
How do you know who I am?
Because Talissa sent me. Tears flow. She collapses on the bed, crying. And I look down at my watch. I sit next to her, my pistol drawn and pointed towards the locked door. Why are you up here with this old dude? She lifts her head, and with a hint of anger, she replies.
Why do you think? I was brought up to be raped. I haven't been behaving, I guess. And this is how they punish you around here.
You've been held with the others? She shakes her head now.
I am getting VIP treatment, I have been told, because I am now the property of the head of the consortium.
This has me momentarily confused. The head of the entire organization?
Yes.
No shit. Who is he?
I don't know. He told me his name was Tom, but that might be a lie. I met him in Romania.
At the nightclub in Bucharest?
Yes.
It's clearly the man from the airplane that Talisa had been tracking. This confirms Roxana's sister's suspicions, but we still don't have any idea who this prick is. I look over at the old dead guy in the robe. To myself, I say, shit, I bet he knew the guy's name. Looking at the girl again, I say, anyone else on board in charge?
There was a South African man. He was making decisions. He calls himself John, but the man lying dead on the floor there talked about someone named Yako. I don't know if that's John's real name or not.
And this Yako guy knows who Tom is? She nods adamantly and sniffs away wet tears.
He was there in Bucharest. They were traveling together, along with a bodyguard named Sean. There were some other bodyguards and some Romanian gangsters there with them, too.
My attention is on this South African, because I'm astonished someone obviously so high up in the organization is here. Getting hold of this guy might be worth the added risk. What does he look like? She describes him, and my hopes are dashed. This is the dude who left with the Greek goons on the tender. He's off the boat now. She raises a finger.
There is someone else. A woman on board, an American psychologist called Dr. Claudia. The entire pipeline is not just a way to move the girls. It is a way to reprogram us for what is to come.
She describes Claudia. I haven't seen such a woman aboard, and I don't think I'll be able to go hunting for her. No, I'll take Roxana in the hopes she can help us identify the men she met in Bucharest, because they are running this entire show. Okay, any chance you know how to scuba? She shakes her head, a distant look in her eyes now. No problem, I'll get you through this. I've staged a rig on the aft deck. We'll get to it. You can breathe from my octopus. It's my spare regulator. It attaches to my tank. We're not going deep. The water is going to be cold without a wetsuit on, but I'll keep my arm around you and we'll stay close together all the way to the shore. We're not very far from...
No.
I stop mid-sentence and shake my head. Not this again. Roxana, no one is going to come after your family. I can protect them. She speaks flatly now.
I'm not leaving the girls below. You have to take us all.
It's just me. I don't have a boat or a submarine or a dozen Navy SEALs. It's just me, alone. How am I going to scuba dive with 25 women? Roxana deflates a little.
The yacht is going to Venice. I know that much. Tomorrow night there is something they call the market. They are going to sell off the women below, plus some more women they are picking up here.
Sell them to who?
Claudia says they'll go to mafia organizations, oil sheiks, high-end prostitution operations around Europe and the Middle East. After tomorrow night in Venice, all these women will be gone, and there will be no way to save them.
I just stare at her and say nothing, because even with this information, I don't know how to save them. She must see the uncertainty on my face.
You just have to go to the police there. They can find out where...
I interrupt with, the cops are useless in this. The pipeline only goes to places where they can control a section of the police. This doesn't seem to surprise Roxana much at all. She just nods, looks to the floor.
I'm being taken to the director. I can lead Talisa to him. I don't know how. Maybe I can find a phone or a computer or something to communicate with her once I get where I'm going and find out where that is.
She's as brave as her sister, but also like her sister. I'm not sure she fully understands what she's in for. Do you have any idea what is likely to happen to you between now and then? With a nod, she says,
Of course. I will be raped, beaten. I'll be punished for you coming here.
I am thinking the same thing, and I don't know if I can deal with more of what I've been feeling since Mostar. Before I can reply, however, I hear a sound outside the bulkhead. an outboard motor, increasing in volume. The tender is returning to the boat.
"Don't let them catch you," she says. "Go."
Telling myself I have a little time, I look away for a moment, and I begin to worry that I don't know the answer to the question I'm compelled to ask. But I have to know. Turning back to her, I say, "What did they do to you after I left the Red Room?" She sits back up on the bed and begins weeping again.
"That night, after you left, they took us into the mountains. Raped some of the girls, maybe most of them. One tried to run. She did not get far."
"They killed her?" In answer, she says,
"She was only a kid."
I feel nausea coming on. I can put up with so much awful shit in this world, but only when it's not my actions that caused it. This child getting murdered, others getting raped, it's on me. Guilt can cripple you, or it can be a driving force. Only your internal strength decides how you respond to your failures. I fight my stomach into submission with a couple of deep, calming breaths. "I'm sorry," is all I can say. She rubs tears from her eyes as she says,
"I'm glad you killed that man. The Serbians had been raping the girls anyway. That is not your fault. And the girl ran because she thought she had an opportunity. Who knows? She might be the luckiest one out of all of us."
Once more, I try to get her to listen to reason. "Not if you come with me right now. I can protect you, Roxana. Trust me." But I see a resolution in her eyes that is so similar to what I've seen from her sister for the past few days that I know it's futile to fight her.
"Tell Talissa I love her."
She breaks down in fresh tears, and I can read it all on her face. She knows this is her one decent shot at survival, and almost definitely her only chance to get out of this situation without being brutalized by her captors. But she is steadfast in her decision. And I know when I'm beat, I'll tell her. She thinks you blame her for what happened. Roxana wipes her eyes again, shakes her head.
"No. I did this. I did this on my own. And I'm going to continue my mission until I find out where this all leads. I'll contact her, and then she and you can come and tear this whole thing apart."
"That sounds like a good plan." I offer my hand to her, and she looks at it. With a beautiful little smile that takes me by surprise, she says,
"I haven't had a man want to shake my hand in a while. Other things, yes, but not that."
I feel bad for what I'm about to do, but I do it anyway. She offers me her hand finally, and I take it in mine, and as I shake it, I say, "I'm gonna have to make this look good. You'll thank me later, but probably only much later." I add, "I'm sorry."
"Sorry about what?"
I pull her up from the bed towards me, and at the same time, I fire out a left hook to her temple, knocking her out cold. And then I catch her and gently lay her down on the floor in a heap. I tear open her sleeveless blouse and position her next to the bodies. I couldn't leave her sitting here in this stateroom untouched with two dead guys lying around. Even if I ran around this boat till everyone saw me and all on board knew an assassin had schwacked this perv and his shithead bodyguard, it would look damn suspicious that I didn't at least hurt her in the process. If she looked in any way complicit in what happened, I couldn't imagine what they'd do to her then. And even now, leaving her here lying on the floor feels wrong on every level. But it was her call to make. I hear the tender on the port side motor away, probably back to the rear of the vessel so it can be winched out of the water, and this tells me everyone is on board. I head to the door, now wondering if I can even get myself out of here before getting killed. Jaco Verdoorn climbed up the ladder and stepped onto the deck. Behind him, the eight women he and the Greek mafia men picked up on the coast of the Croatian city of Rovinja ascended, one by one, until they all stood there with him, squinting in the bright light. Though there were eight in this shipment, only seven of them would be generating revenue for the organization, One of them, and Verdurin eyed her as she climbed aboard, was a special handling item. A beautiful Hungarian blonde. Cage had seen her at the ballet in Budapest with his wife several months earlier, and he demanded she be pulled into the pipeline. She'd be taken along with Maya to the West Coast, used by Cage and his friends and business partners at Rancho Esmeralda, and then cast away after Cage found a new crop on his future trips abroad. When all the women stood on the deck, Dr. Riesling gave her little speech to the new arrivals. They were promised food and a shower, and then the guards began leading them into the saloon to go down the stairs to the lower deck. As they descended, Verdurin stepped up to Riesling.
Where is Kostopoulos?
He had Maya brought up to his room 15 minutes ago. Honestly, I'm surprised he's lasted this long. Usually he's done with them in 10.
Verdurin's eyes narrowed, and Riesling added,
Don't worry, I told him no permanent marks.
One of the Greek guards came out of the saloon, looked around, and then spun away as he spoke into his walkie-talkie. Verdurin noted the mannerisms of this man, and when a second one of Costas's force came running up the main deck, himself showing worry and purposefulness, the South African grabbed him by the arm.
What is the problem?
In English, the guard said,
One of our men we know can find.
Jaco had his pistol out of his coat an instant later, and he looked at Dr. Riesling.
Get the product below. You stay with them.
The American woman began ushering the girls into the saloon, but to Verdurin she said,
What's the matter?
Verdurin was already moving into the saloon, his pistol out in front of him, searching the area as he headed for the circular staircase, but he called back behind him in answer to the doctor's question.
The gray man. He's on board.
How do you?
Because I can feel him.
30. I take stairs up to the open sun deck and then, after checking the area below for armed goons, I kick a leg over the rail and slide down the slick white side of the vessel, landing hard but quietly on the main deck. This portion of the boat is well lit, and I see movement up near the bow, but it's only a deckhand facing away from me, far enough forward on the 150-foot vessel that I'm not worried about him. My goal is the aft deck and the scuba equipment I've staged there. Once I get it on, I plan on using the sea stairs to make my way into the water silently. I begin heading aft in a low crouch along the starboard side main deck. I don't make it far before a voice comes over the loudspeaker. He's speaking Greek and he's agitated, shouting commands. I forego the crouch and haul ass the last 25 feet, pretty certain the reason this guy has his panties in a twist is that he just found out some asshole is killing people on his boat. Sure enough, the man switches to English and says words to that effect.
Alert! Trespasser on board! He is armed! All security to the main deck!
I slow and peek around the corner of the aft deck, and here I see a couple of deckhands winching the tender, along with one guy wearing a dark polo and holding a subgun in one hand and a radio up to his ear in the other. He's facing the saloon, and he's between me and the diving equipment I need. I think about just pulling the Glock from the pack hanging from my chest and shooting him, but I need a few seconds to get the tank valve opened and to put the equipment on. And even if I put the suppressor on my weapon first, everybody on the deck is still going to hear the gunshot. So instead, I just start walking towards the armed man purposefully, but non-threateningly. He's 20 feet from me when he lowers the walkie-talkie and looks in my direction. But all he sees is a diver in a wetsuit, his face partially hidden by the hood, heading to the scuba rack. My pack probably looks a little weird. Not many people dive with luggage, but he's unsure enough to allow me to close on him. Another few steps and it won't matter what he does. The man on the loudspeaker says something else, and the guard in the polo swings his submachine gun towards me, but I'm 2 steps away now, and I cover them faster than he can fire. I knock the weapon away, spear the man in the throat, and slam my knee into his face as he doubles forward. The deck crew begins shouting. I reach for the guard's weapon, but he crumples to the ground before I can wrench it away. Giving up on both the gun and stealth, giving up on everything but getting my ass in the water, I lunge for the scuba rig I placed in the corner.
Hefting the 50 pounds of gear, I spin back towards the stern. The deckhands look like they want to make trouble, and my hands are full, so fighting them is not an option. So I juke to the left and run for the starboard side, and they give chase. A gunshot cracks on my left as I make it to the starboard deck. I shift my body around as I hit the railing and start to go over, hoping to use the tank as a makeshift bulletproof vest. Another gunshot rocks the night, and I feel the impact as the bullet strikes my tank just as I tumble over the side, falling headfirst with all my gear slung over my shoulder. Splashing into the cold black water, I realize I'm clear from the immediate threat of guns, but I've landed into a new threat. I'm heavily laden with equipment and weights, and I'm descending quickly. I could let go of everything, just allow the tank and equipment to drop, but I won't do that because I'm wearing a wetsuit that adds buoyancy to my already buoyant body, so I'll just shoot to the surface. And the surface is where the jackasses with guns are. Somehow, I have to open the air valve on the tank, get the vest onto my body and buckled in, arrest the descent by adding air to the vest, and then find my regulator and get it into my mouth so I can breathe. With my eyes closed, because my mask is in the pack of my chest. All before I drown. But I'm not thinking about this, I'm doing this. I pull the entire rig off my shoulder and place it in front of me below my pack. Wrapping my legs around the steel tank, I crank open the valve. As my ears scream from my rapid descent, I muscle my way into the BCD, snap one of the three quick release buckles to keep it on, and whip my hand around wildly for my regulator. I find the hose and grab the mouthpiece, then pop it into my mouth, inhaling deeply. Salt water rushes into my mouth and lungs. Gagging, I realize the bullet that hit the tank must have ricocheted and damaged the hose to the regulator. So I release it and yank down on the emergency regulator, tucked into my vest, knowing that if the hose on the octopus is also damaged, then I'm a dead man. The panic welling in my chest now is as painful as the pressure against my eardrums. I put the octopus in my mouth, push the purge button so I can spit out the seawater, and then try a shallow breath. Air has never felt so good going into my body. Breathing normally now, I continue to sink, so I pump just a little air into my vest to slow my descent, then open my pack to retrieve my mask. I get it over my eyes, and then clear it of water by lifting the bottom of it off my cheeks and breathing out my nose. Then I pinch my nose through my mask and simulate several sneezes, and this quickly regulates the pressure in my ears and the pounding pain goes away. I pull my fins out and slip them over my boots, then more securely tighten my BCD to my body. I tie off the regulator hose to slow the loss of air from the tank. It continues to leak. I can feel bubbles brushing against my face, but it's better than it was. Finally convinced I'm not going to die in the next 10 seconds, I look at the illuminated depth gauge and find myself nearly 70 feet below the surface. From the deck of the Primorosa, it looked like about 500 yards to the nearest shoreline, and farther to the marina at Rovigna. So, with the leak in the hose, I don't have any time to wait around. I add more air to my vest, finally arresting my descent at 80 feet, then pull the red flashlight and turn it on. With it, I see I am 10 feet above the sandy and rocky ocean floor. I turn off the light and begin kicking to the east, using the illuminated compass on my BCD to guide me. That went well, I think, with no small amount of sarcasm. Jaco Verdurin leapt off the back of La Primorosa and into the tender. Already three Greeks armed with submachine guns and powerful flashlights were on board, and the tender captain fired the engine and spun the craft tightly back around to the east.
Watch for bubbles!
Verdurin ordered the men. He snatched a light from the hands of one of the gangsters, knowing his handgun was no more useful than the other weapons on board against a man more than a couple feet below the surface. He was furious now, wild with rage. This was all bad. The death of the Greek, the poor security of the yacht that allowed the assassin to board, the inevitable questions that would come from Cage about Verdurin's own actions that did not prevent this. But still, Jaco recognized that the prevailing emotion he felt as they shot over the water, scanning back and forth with the flashlights, was one of incredible excitement. He wondered if he, right now, was closer to killing the infamous gray man than any other man had ever been. and he relished this opportunity more than anything he'd ever done in his life. Yako was in the zone. As the Zodiac began weaving left and right, covering virtually the only track the diver could have reasonably taken to get to land, Verdun called into his radio back to La Primorosa.
I want three divers suited up and armed with spear guns. Put them in the reserve tender and send them to our position. I saw him when he went in the water, and he did not have a spear gun. We're going to kill him right here, right now.
Seconds later, one of the Greeks at the bow shouted,
Bubbles! 1 o'clock, 20 meters!
The tender adjusted course, and soon Verdun could see the bubbles himself. All the men shined their lights on them, till Verdun ordered them to shine straight down. The water reflected the light, and they couldn't see any signs of the diver other than the bubbles he made. Verdun, an avid diver himself back in the shark-infested waters of South Africa, regarded the bubbles a moment, and then he smiled.
That's constant. Not just from breathing. Bloody bastard sprung a leak.
He knew he'd hit Gentry's tank as he'd fallen into the water. Apparently, the scuba gear had taken some damage. Shouting into the radio, he said,
Hurry those divers! He's 400 meters from land!
I keep kicking my freediving fins, using the light as sporadically as possible to make certain I don't slam into a rock wall. I'm 50 feet below the surface now, just a few feet over the bottom as it slowly angles up towards the shoreline. I check my air and realize the leak in my regulator is worse than I thought. I've expelled almost 1/3 already, and I've only been in the cold water 5 minutes or so. Normally, I could make a tank this size last an hour at this depth with this level of exertion. But now it looks like I have less than 15 minutes to get where I'm going, or I'll have to swim it on the surface. I see the glow of lights shining down, so I know my bubbles have ratted out my position. There's not much I can do but keep kicking towards the shore, hoping I make it before the tank bleeds dry. I push this out of my mind as I press on, and I begin thinking about Roxana, about Talissa, about the younger sister's drive for the acceptance of her older sister, and the older sister's drive to assuage her guilt and risk her own life to fix her mistake. I am amazed by the reserve some people have, and I wonder about the drive inside the bellies of the men in the rubber boat above me. What lengths will they go to in order to kill me tonight? I hear the faint sound of another tender now, and I have an idea that those above, or at least the ones in charge of them, are more than passionate about seeing to my demise. I suspect there will be divers in the water now, and my shitty situation has only become more so. I look down to the air pressure indicator, see that half my air is gone, and I wonder if I'm fucked. No, I'm not. I tell myself that nobody on or in this water tonight has more drive to execute his mission than I do. It may not happen tonight, and it sure doesn't look like it right now, but I'm going to find these guys above me, and I'm going to fuck them up.
The tender with the three divers turned hard to port 50 meters ahead of the northernmost of the trail of bubbles appearing on the gently undulating waves. They were just 150 meters from the Rovinia Marina, but they estimated they were closer to land than their target below. Verdun used his flashlight to indicate a position in the water, and he called out to them from his craft, just ahead and to the right of the telltale trail.
Right there! I want you all in the water there! Get down and spear the diver. Bring his body up to me.
The South African wished he'd had time to throw a tank on himself. If he had a scuba rig with him on board, he would have donned it right over his clothing and dived in, ready to wring the gray man's neck if his hands were the only weapons available to him. Just as the three divers sat on the gunwale of the smaller tender closer to shore, one of the Greeks on Verdun's craft shouted out,
Wait! He's changing directions!
Verdun looked at the surface of the black water, and sure enough, the bubbles had begun trailing from due east to southeast, towards a tiny spit of land far from the marina and only about 100 meters distant. The South African said,
That way! He's running out of air and going for the nearest land. Get ahead of him and dive!
The smaller tender raced off, the divers held on tightly to keep from tipping back and in, and soon it had traveled 50 meters to the southeast. The dinghy turned sharply to slow, and then the divers rolled backwards into the water, grabbed their spear guns from their hips, and turned on their underwater flashlights. The seafloor was only 25 feet below the surface here, but there were rocks and valleys and swim-throughs all the way to the shoreline. One of the three banged his flashlight on his tank to draw the attention of the others, then used his light to indicate a shallow cavern just off to their left behind them, farther from the shore than the divers. Here, a steady stream of bubbles rose swiftly towards the surface, moving along towards the shore. All three men spread out, keeping their lights on the bubbles and the hidden portion of the seafloor below them, and they converged from the east, west, and south, their spear guns loaded and cocked with enough tension to drive the steel shanks straight through a diver's body. As they arrived above the narrow little chasm, their beams shot back and forth until the origin of the expelling air became apparent. All three men held their positions above the source, unsure what they were looking at for a moment, but they finally put it together. It was a scuba tank with its regulator removed, spewing air from its open valve. The spewing gases propelled the device in the water. The attached buoyancy control device had adjusted enough air to keep it jetting along slowly but steadily, some dozen feet above the ocean floor. But there was no diver attached to the equipment. All three men spun around, back to the north, and they began kicking as hard as they could as they ascended, certain now the gray man could only be found at the surface, because he only had the air left in his lungs. 2 minutes ago, I knelt on the ocean floor, 33 feet below the gentle waves. Here I took off my BCD vest, turned off the tank, removed the regulator, and then reopened the valve slightly. Sucking in one last mouthful of unpressurized air directly from the tank, I used one hand to reach down to pull two stones from the seafloor, while with the other hand I pointed the bottom of the steel canister towards the south and cranked open the valve the rest of the way. The entire scuba rig began jetting away like a very slow torpedo, and I turned to the northeast, kicking myself into shallower water while ascending slightly as I swam. The stones are keeping me from shooting to the surface now, but once I'm halfway up, I drop one of them. I'm not breathing, so there are no bubbles. The only trail evident on the water above me should be the air from the tank, now probably 50 yards away or more, and heading in the opposite direction. I'm hoping the tenders take the bait, and by the fact that I can't hear the outboard motors any longer, I feel certain they have. At 5 feet below the surface, I kick as hard and as fast as I can, until my lungs scream in agony, and then I let the other rock drop from my hands. The only things weighing me down now are the few items in my pack, so I rise easily to the surface. I don't take my head out of the water, only blow out through the snorkel and then back in, still kicking, but making sure to kick in a way that doesn't make a splash or allow my long fins to come out of the water. God, I love breathing. Finally, I raise my mask up to get my bearings. The marina at Rovinia is lit with street lamps, but no one is in sight this late. It's straight ahead, less than 50 yards away, and I cover this distance in under 2 minutes. Here I climb ashore, look back out to the bay, and see a pair of little boats racing around, far to my southwest, flashlights whipping in all directions. The near constant voice of a man, shouting what sounds like both orders and admonitions, rolls over the water to me. Removing my fins and mask, I adjust my pack on my back and start running for the warren of streets that make up the old town district of the small city, ready to disappear in an alleyway till the coast is clear. My plan is to call Talissa to see where she is, then steal yet another car and pick her up. For now, that's where my plan ends. But I just demonstrated to myself that I'm pretty fucking good on the fly. I accomplished nothing more tonight than finding out the city where the market is being held, but it's enough to move forward. Still, it's becoming more and more obvious that Talissa and I aren't going to be able to pull this off on our own. So, my thoughts start drifting to a phone call that I really should make, but one that I really don't want to make. 31. The sleek Gulfstream 650 flew 36,000 feet above northern Illinois, heading east from Van Nuys on its way to Venice, Italy. On board, Kenneth Cage sat in the center of the cabin facing forward, and he dined on roast duck, sipping a light Pinot Noir along with it. He was surrounded in the aircraft by other men, seven in all, but his attention during dinner was on a notebook computer on the tray next to him. More specifically, the spreadsheet reporting this fiscal year's revenue from merchandise trafficked from the East and into Scandinavia. Estonia was producing some excellent product these days, but the real numbers were still coming from Belarus, where the poor economy and difficult conditions made it exponentially easier to dupe young girls into heading west for more opportunity. The economy in the Baltic had developed greatly in contrast, and this made it tougher on an enterprise like Cage's. The consortium preyed on the downtrodden. Those who wouldn't be missed, or if they were, would be missed only by those without the means to come looking for them. Still, Scandinavia was generating tens of millions of euros in revenue, and Cage was happy enough with the reporting. He was just biting into a forkful of saffron orzo when the phone on the table next to him chirped. He picked it up without looking.
Yeah?
Across from the director of the consortium, his chief protection agent, Sean Hall, sat facing aft, also dining on the roast duck. He regarded his boss as he chewed, then looked around the cabin at his full six-man executive protection detail, here to help him ensure Cage's safety on this trip. Everyone on the team drank either wine or beer, a rare occurrence when around the principal, but for the next 10 hours or so, they had no duties whatsoever. Once they got where they were going, however, Hall knew they'd be working as hard as any of these men had worked since they'd served in combat or in critical SWAT callouts. Hall sipped more wine, taking advantage of the rare opportunity, but his thoughts shifted to the job ahead. They would land at Marco Polo Airport in Venice early afternoon local time, and then Cage would be taken in a motorboat out to La Primorosa, with Hall and his six men surrounding him. And then, around 11 p.m., Cage would go to the sale of the women to shake hands with some of his clients, again, at the nucleus of a large security operation. Everything in Hall's training told him this was a bad idea. This entire trip was Cage flexing his muscle to him and Yako to show he wasn't scared of this gray man and wouldn't be ordered around by his subordinates. Hall thought it to be an asinine risk, just so his boss could get some tail that was on its way to him anyway. The 40-year-old ex-Navy SEAL kept his eyes on the shorter, older American while Cage took the call, only because the two men were facing each other. But when Cage leaned back in his chair with an unmistakable look of exasperation on his face, Hall quickly tried to listen in to the one half of the conversation in his earshot.
You're kidding. Wait. Tell me you're kidding.
Then,
fuck! This has gotten completely out of hand,
Cage shouted into the receiver, drawing the attention of everyone in the cabin.
What the hell am I paying you bastards for?
Sean Hall's roast duck was forgotten now, as was the wine. From the context of Cage's words and the expression on his face, he knew this would be Yako on the line, and Yako would be telling him that yet something else had happened somewhere along the Balkan pipeline. This had turned into a security emergency, Hall was certain. And as the head of security, he told himself he was now officially back on the clock. He snapped his fingers at his closest man, who was just bringing his bottle of Stella Artois to his lips. Hall said,
Dude, stop drinking. Pass it along.
Hall called the attractive flight attendant over, handed her his glass of wine, and told her to clean up the glasses and plates on his men's trays. Hall had a bottle of vodka in his kit bag, but right now his alcoholism wasn't a problem because he was more concerned with keeping himself and his principal alive for the next several hours. He climbed out of his cabin chair and sat down next to his boss, who was still talking on the phone. Cage said,
You're damn right I will. Just because you can't do your job doesn't mean I'm not going to do mine. I swear to God, Yako, you need to get this shit handled, or I'll bring in people who can. Am I clear?
There was another minute of talk, seemingly about one of the girls in the process of being trafficked, and then Cage slammed the phone down, thumped his head back into the leather headrest again, and closed his eyes. Hall knew better than to speak up right now. He'd only get his head bitten off by the mercurial 54-year-old.
Finally, the director of the consortium turned to look at his director of security.
Kostopoulos is dead. Strangled to death on his own yacht.
What?
It was the Gray Man.
Sean's heart began to pound. Verdun was on the yacht, wasn't he? With a quick nod, Cage said,
Yako says he shot at the fucker as he was making his getaway.
Apparently without effect.
Christ, Ken. If he was on the boat and he got away, then that boat is compromised.
Cage shrugged at this.
Yako says the girls are going to be moved to shore as soon as they get to Venice. They're already on the way and will arrive in less than 3 hours. They'll put them up at a private house and we'll take them to market from there.
Hall took a slow breath, steeling himself for the fight that he knew was to come, then said,
This was already an extremely difficult security equation when you were protected by the yacht and the water around it. We were going to take you to market via a skiff, and you wouldn't have to walk through those narrow pedestrian streets while an assassin targeted you. But now you are telling me that's just exactly what we're doing.
No offense, Ken, but that's crazy. We need to turn this jet around right now and call it a day.
Cage looked off into space a few seconds. Hall knew all his men were watching this interaction between their boss and their protectee.
Finally, the director of the consortium said,
Yako says his men will check out the route, and they'll position themselves accordingly. All you and your boys have to do is catch any bullets that come my way.
That doesn't sound too hard, does it, Sean?
Hall tried another approach.
How about we take you to this private residence? You spend the afternoon and evening there, meet all the girls, spend all night with the special handling merchandise, but don't go to the market. It's just too dangerous.
Sean, let me explain to you a few things about the responsibilities of being in charge. People will know I'm in Venice, and they will expect me to come for the festivities. Not if there is a world-class gunman out there hunting for—
I'm going! You and these other guys, Yako and his shock troops, the local mob who administrates the market, all of you just do what I pay you to do, and there will be nothing to worry about.
Hall knew that changing his employer's mind was going to be a long shot, and, like he'd anticipated, his long shot had failed, so he nodded without speaking and moved to the front bulkhead. Here he called his men up with him, and they sat, stood, or knelt close while their team leader talked about updates to their plans. And while Hall spoke, he fumed. The ire he felt was not directed towards Cage, or at least the majority of it was not. He was instead furious at Yako Verdun, because apparently Yako had just told his boss that, despite all evidence to the contrary, the situation was under control and it was safe to come to Venice. But Sean Hall knew something Ken Cage did not. He knew Yako Verdun was as giddy as a schoolgirl at the prospect of going up against the uber-assassin Gentry, and he wasn't above using his employer as bait to draw his prey in. Hall wasn't going to tell Cage his concerns. He knew he didn't have the juice to get into an inter-office political war with Yako Verdun. The South African was higher in the food chain than Hall, and Hall knew Verdun would simply turn Cage against him if this morphed into a real fight between them. No. Even though Hall had nothing but misgivings about this operation in Venice, he would do what all good military men and women are taught to do when they don't like an order. Salute and draw fire. He'd do what was asked of him, and he'd find a way to get his employer through the next 24 hours. He thought of his bottle of vodka in his kit bag and wondered if he'd be able to sneak a few swigs before landing. Roxana Vaduva lay on the bed in her stateroom on the lower deck, locked in with an armed Greek security man standing right outside the door. Dr. Claudia sat on the edge of the bed next to her, an ice pack in her hand, and she held it to the young Romanian woman's right temple.
You are going to be okay, young lady. You are very lucky.
Lucky? The old man raped me, and then some man in a mask killed him right in front of me, then beat me up. Why don't I feel lucky?
The truth was, Roxana had not, in fact, been raped by Kostopoulos, but she wasn't going to reveal that to the American psychologist. Claudia said,
"Lucky to be alive."
She pulled the ice away.
"And lucky to be still considered a friend. By me, at least." "What do you mean?"
"John doesn't believe your story. He finds it suspicious you were only knocked out, and he thinks you might have spoken with the assassin. He thinks the man was here to help you." Roxana drew on her acting background now.
"Then where is the help?"
"We watched the playbacks of cameras around the boat. The assassin was in Costas's room for almost 5 minutes before he appeared on the main deck and jumped into the water. Plenty of time for you to talk to him."
"He knocked me out. I don't know what he did in the room while I was unconscious. He didn't kill me, because I wasn't what he was after. It's pretty obvious, even to me, that he came to kill the old man."
Claudia regarded her closely, but Roxana didn't waver. Finally, the doctor said,
"I am inclined to believe you, but John, I warned you about him. He will follow the director's orders, but I'd keep my eyes open if I were you. Did you tell the old man to do what he did?" "Of course not. But these are powerful men with powerful desires. I can't control what they do. Neither can you. Honestly, though, I think what happened to you is for the best."
"For the best?"
"You needed to learn your place in all this. You have to give to get in this world, and you will be getting a lot of good things the moment you do your part. I hope this difficult lesson was beneficial."
Roxana knew she needed to be the best actress she could be now.
I understand. I don't want that to happen again."
She looked down at the floor, then lifted her eyes back to the American woman.
"If the director can protect me, then I will behave."
Claudia smiled.
"Very good. I am so pleased the program has helped educate you in all this, and just in time, too. The director will be here this evening, and he wants to see you."
The young Romanian fought tears until Claudia dabbed her face once more with the ice and then handed it to her. Then the American left the stateroom, and when the door closed, Roxana closed her eyes, holding the ice there on her temple where it throbbed. Tom was coming here. Her entire objective in staying on the boat had been to learn who he was, where he was, and what was at the end of this entire pipeline. This information she'd have to get to her sister some way. But now that she knew the American director was coming to her, she wondered how the hell she was supposed to contact her once she had what she needed. She fought more tears and told herself to be strong. Her resolve had gotten her this far through this mess, and all she could do now was do her best. I pull off the road less than 10 kilometers south of Rovinia. My stolen Ford Focus rolls slowly along the rough shoulder as I peer into the darkness, but soon I see what I'm looking for. Talissa comes out of the brush, waves at me, and then climbs into the passenger seat. She'd taken the boat along the shore, following La Primorosa with me on board, until her engine began to sputter, and then she'd beached the little craft and begun walking to the north. She looks as exhausted as I feel, but her alert, hopeful, and expectant eyes belie all she's been through.
"Are you okay?"
she asks as we pull back on the road.
"Yeah."
I start to say more, but then I hesitate. I don't know how to tell her what I need to tell her.
"You got on board, obviously."
"I did."
"Well, what did you see?"
Looking forward through the windshield as I drive through the morning, I say, "Your sister is alive." Glancing her way, I see her bring both hands to her mouth, and I can see her face redden even here in the darkened car. Finally, she asks,
"You saw her?"
"I spoke with her."
"Oh my God."
"She is okay. For now, I think, all but certain that things are only going to get worse for Roxana."
"But where is she? I need to see her."
"She's Actually, she's still on the yacht. Out of the corner of my eye, I see her lower her hands to her lap. Her tone changes, becoming angry and challenging.
I don't understand. Why didn't you rescue her?
I tried. She wouldn't go. They've told her she's being taken to the director of the consortium, and she sees this as the best chance to blow the doors wide open on this entire trafficking ring. I add, she's doing it for you. This is hard for the Romanian woman to accept. She argues with me for a minute, insinuates that I should have popped her sister on the head.